Music Show. That's after a summary of the news this lunchtime, the time being 1 o'clock. It's read by Lopa Qatari.
Thousands of Egyptians have gathered in Tahrir Square in the capital, Cairo, to hear the outcome of the country's first contested presidential election. Unofficial figures have suggested that the candidate of the Muslim Brotherhood, Mohamed Morsi, won a narrow victory over his rival, the former Prime Minister and retired Air Force Commander Ahmed Shafiq. Both candidates have claimed victory. The Prime Minister has called for a debate on the welfare system, saying the current system of housing benefit sends out the signal that people are better off not working. David Cameron says housing benefit for the under-25s costs a fortune, nearly £2 billion a year. The Chief Secretary to the Treasury, the Liberal Democrat, Danny Alexander, says he believes the right thing to do is to let the current welfare reforms bed in before further decisions are taken. Turkey has sent an official message to Syria, setting out a diplomatic protest at Syria's shooting down of a Turkish aircraft on Friday. The Foreign Secretary, William Hague, has said Britain will support Turkey if it demands the right of the United Nations to take robust action against its neighbour. Tony Blair has said the crisis in the Eurozone is now so deep that a grand plan is required to rescue it. The former Prime Minister said Germany would have to accept that the debts of all the countries were shared, and in return, they would have to spell out their plans for economic change. The Archbishop of Canterbury, Dr. Rowan Williams, has dismissed David Cameron's Big Society as a ploy to conceal what he called a deeply damaging withdrawal of the state from its responsibilities to the most vulnerable. Dr. Williams, who will stand down in December, calls the idea aspirational waffle in a new book. And finally, the weather. Sunny spells and scattered showers across the country will be most frequent and heavy in Scotland, northern England and East Anglia, with a chance of a few thunderstorms. The showers will become more isolated elsewhere, with most areas becoming dry into the late afternoon. And that's the latest BBC News and weather. The time is 2 minutes past one.
Lopa, thank you very much indeed. We're off to Bregenz in Austria for our Sunday concert this week. The BBC Philharmonic plays Shostakovich and Mahler, the first of Shostakovich's cello concertos and Mahler's Fifth Symphony. That's our Sunday concert in an hour from now at two. But next, this lunchtime, it's time for today's Early Music Show. Here's Catherine Bott.
Hello. In today's programme, I'm taking a look at the life and work of an 18th century philosopher whose writings influenced the French Revolution. Perhaps his most famous maxim is, "Man is born free, but everywhere he is in chains." You're probably ahead of me already. I'm talking about Jean-Jacques Rousseau. And he's the subject of today's Early Music Show, partly because he was born 300 years ago, on the 28th of June, 1712, but mainly because he wrote music of sundry kinds, including seven operas. He made a significant contribution to contemporary thinking on music theory, and played his part in a famous musical squabble that could only have arisen in the partisan world of opera, the Querelle des Bouffons. And although he's well remembered now for his philosophical works, he spent much of his life wanting to be known as a poet and composer.
Je prétends à vos pieds ramener le vol.
A touching scene from the intermezzo Le Devin du Village, The Village Soothsayer, by Jean-Jacques Rousseau. Country girl Colette fears that she has been betrayed by Colin the shepherd as he pursues a sophisticated lady, and the village wise man sees no reason to disabuse her. The singers on that recording were Gabriela Bürgler and Dominique Werner, with Cantus Firmus consort directed by Andreas Reitzer. You'll have gathered from my introduction that Rousseau was a man of many parts, but in today's programme I'm sticking to his musical life. One tends to think of him as French, but he was actually Swiss-born. His mother was the daughter of a Calvinist preacher, and his father a well-educated watchmaker. Rousseau's early musical education wasn't really up to much. He had singing and recorder lessons, but when it came to composition, he was largely self-taught, mainly from reading and annotating a treatise on harmony by Rameau. He ran away in his mid-teens, not just from a divided family, but from Switzerland, ending up in neighbouring Savoy. A Catholic priest gave him shelter and introduced the Protestant teenager Rousseau to Françoise Louise de Varennes, a noblewoman in her late 20s who was a professional lay proselytizer for Catholicism. An intoxicating mix, Rousseau was ripe for conversion, among other things, and was sent to a seminary in Turin. Most of what's known about Rousseau's early life can be read in the several volumes of his posthumously published Confessions. Here's what he has to say about the older woman who seems to have been the love of his life. "I went to the seminary with about the same spirits as if they had been taking me to execution. What a melancholy abode, especially for one who left the house of a pretty woman. Among the talents she had cultivated, music was not forgotten. She had a tolerable good voice, sang agreeably, and played on the harpsichord. She had taken the pains to give me some lessons in singing. 8 or 10 interrupted lessons did not teach me half the notes. Notwithstanding, I had such a passion for the art that I determined to exercise myself alone. The book I took was not of the most easy kind. It was the Cantatas of Clérambault. It may be conceived with what attention and perseverance I studied when I inform my reader that without knowing anything of transposition or quantity, I contrived to sing with tolerable correctness." Thank you. Music from Clérambault's cantata Médée, with soprano Rachel Yakar, violinist Reinhard Goebel, flautist Wilbert Hatzelset, viol player Charles Medlem, and harpsichordist Alan Curtis. "I was unconsciously learning music as I taught it," wrote Rousseau. And although details of his next few years are sketchy, it does seem that he made a living as a teacher of singing and composition from his late teens onwards. Throughout his life, whenever he needed the money, he would take on work as a music copyist. And sometimes he enjoyed being creative with other composers' material. Here's part of his arrangement of Spring from Vivaldi's Four Seasons, arranged for unaccompanied flute. Mario Follena playing Vivaldi, arranged by Jean-Jacques Rousseau. In 1742, when he was already 30 years old, Rousseau developed a new figured notation for music with which he hoped to make his fortune. He moved to Paris, where he presented this new method to the Academy of Sciences. Sadly, the Academy rejected it as impractical, though they did encourage him to continue with his work. The contrary Rousseau abandoned the idea immediately, and having already written some music of his own, one song and one opera, he began work on a new opera, Les Muses Galantes, and took what he called an honourable but ill-paying post as secretary to the French ambassador to Venice. Another turning point. Here's more from his confessions. I had brought with me from Paris the prejudice of that city against Italian music, but I had also received from nature a sensibility and niceness of distinction which prejudice cannot withstand. I soon contracted that passion for Italian music with which it inspires all those who are capable of feeling its excellence. In listening to Barcarolle, I found I had not yet known what singing was. A kind of music far superior, in my opinion, to that of operas, is that of the scuole, houses of charity established for the education of young girls without fortune, to whom the Republic afterwards gives a portion, either in marriage or for the cloister. Every Sunday at the church of each of the four scuole, motettos or anthems with full choruses, accompanied by a great orchestra and composed and directed by the best masters in Italy, are sung in the galleries by girls only, not one of whom is more than 20 years of age. I have not an idea of anything so voluptuous and affecting as this music. The richness of the art, the exquisite taste of the vocal part, the excellence of the voices, the justness of the execution, everything in these delightful concerts concurs to produce an impression which certainly is not the mode, but from which I am of opinion no heart is secure.
Oh,
Music by Porpora, written for the charitable Ospedali of Venice. Three movements from his setting of the De Profundis, performed by the Vocal and Instrumental Consorts of Dresden, directed by Peter Kopp. Rousseau's new passion for Italian music is important. A grand dispute between French and Italian style was brewing. Back in Paris, Rousseau continued work on his very French-style opera, Les Muses Galantes, and sought the opinion of the alpha male French composer, Rameau. Rameau was discouraging. He declared the music to be partly the work of an inspired melodist and partly that of a musical ignoramus, adding later that the only good bits were clearly so Italianate that Rousseau couldn't possibly have written them. This was a blow, but one that Rousseau should perhaps have foreseen. He wasn't as highly trained as Rameau, and unwise to compare himself with such a gifted and successful musician. He admitted in his confessions that his main reason for wishing to be acknowledged as a composer was to show his superiority to other philosophers. So his professional agenda was complex. Meanwhile, despite his low standing in Rameau's eyes, Rousseau received a prestigious commission to revise the opera La Princesse de Navarre, on which Voltaire and Rameau himself had collaborated, as an extravaganza with dancing to celebrate a recent French military victory. Ballet music by Rameau from his opera La Princesse de Navarre, Nicholas McGeegan conducting the English Bach Festival Baroque Orchestra. The piece that Rousseau fashioned out of that opera, called Les Fêtes de Ramire, was performed at Versailles in 1745, but claims and counterclaims regarding plagiarism continued to pursue him. In the seventh volume of his Confessions, he states that he was responsible for the overture and some recitatives, but that Rameau and Voltaire had stolen all the credit. However, it seems that only one monologue has been positively identified as Rousseau's. The feud with Rameau looked set to run and run. In 1748-9, Rousseau's contemporary and rival philosophe, Denis Diderot, asked Rousseau to compile the articles on music in a new encyclopedia. Writing anonymously, he went to town, rather, with criticisms of Rameau's harmonic system. Rameau didn't take this lying down and came right back at his critic. Surely he must have had some idea as to who he was, with a piece called Erreur sur la musique dans l'encyclopédie. By the time he was middle-aged, Rousseau clearly cared even more about his intellectual standing among Parisian philosophers than his position in its musical firmament. How else can one interpret this witty but mean-spirited piece satirising the goings-on at the opera? The actresses are almost in convulsions, forcing loud cries from their lungs, with their hands clenched against their breasts, their heads thrown back, their countenances inflamed, their veins swollen and their bodies heaving. It is difficult to know if the eye or the ear is the more disagreeably affected. Their efforts cause as much suffering to those who look at them as their singing does to those who listen to them. And what is really inconceivable is that this shrieking is almost the only thing applauded by the audience. By the clapping of hands, one would take them for deaf people, who were so delighted now and then to catch a few piercing sounds that they wished the actors to redouble their efforts. As for the orchestra, it was an unending clatter of instruments which no one could put up with for half an hour without getting a violent headache. This tumult was led by a conductor whom Rousseau calls the woodcutter, because he expended as much energy on marking time from his desk by strokes of his baton as he would for cutting down a tree. Rousseau's written output on non-musical matters was considerable over several decades, although the two philosophical-political works for which he became most famous were yet to appear when he finally achieved proper musical success with his Italian-influenced intermezzo Le Devin du Village. We heard a scene from that at the beginning of the programme. Rousseau wrote both words and music for The Village Soothsayer, which was performed first at court and then at the Royal Academy of Music. The one-act piece was a huge instant success and was to stay in the repertoire of the Paris Opera for 60 years. The piece has just three characters, rustic lovers Colin and Colette and the village wise man. And it embodies Rousseau's ideal of rusticity and simplicity, which was about to become hugely fashionable. Let's hear something from the final scene in which bucolic happiness at last prevails. In the town there's more hustle and bustle, but are they happy? Do their concerts measure up to our musettes? Lads, take up your pipes. Let's dance under the green elms. An everyday story of country folk, written by a sophisticated philosopher who lived in the hustle and bustle of Paris. Gabriella Bürgler as Colette, with Cantus Firmus Choir and Consort, directed by Andreas Reitzer. Le Devin is irresistibly charming and expressive. It's also full of technical weaknesses which expose Rousseau's lack of professional training. But it delighted France. King Louis XV even offered the composer a lifelong pension. And Rousseau had the sheer brass neck to turn it down, preferring to be known as the man who had refused a king's pension. He was rather prone to snatching defeat from the jaws of victory. Perhaps he preferred a life of victimhood and grudges. Accordingly, as soon as the success of Le Devin was assured, he flung himself into a verbal battle over the relative merits of French and Italian opera, the Querelle des Bouffons, the quarrel of the comic actors. It was all sparked off by Pergolesi and a performance of his intermezzo La Serva Padrona at the Royal Academy in August 1752, given by an Italian troupe of comic actors, or buffoni, hence Buffon in French. Oddly enough, it wasn't the first time the piece had been heard in Paris, but this time it was the excuse for a diverting controversy between Rousseau and other contributors to the Encyclopedia, who championed Italian music, and die-hard French musicians who were, well, chauvinists for the tradition of Lully and Rameau. Although that's a concept of a later period, so I suppose I should say chauvinists avant la lettre. Rousseau's Lettres sur la musique française appeared in 1753. In it, he championed Italian music for its moral qualities, based as it was on melody and the voice. French music, on the other hand, was a deliberate perversion in which language and music became divorced, resulting in cacophony. He wanted the French to learn instead from Pergolesi.
Oh,
A duet from Pergolesi's La Serva Padrona, sung by Katalin Farkas and Josef Gregor, with Capella Savaria, directed by Paul Nemeth. It was in this period that Rousseau began to become a more controversial figure in France. He reconverted to Calvinism in order to reclaim Genevan citizenship, and in 1754 he completed his second major philosophical work, The Discourse on the Origin and Basis of Inequality Among Men. And he had a bit of a midlife crisis, falling out with his patroness and landlady, Madame d'Épinay. She often hosted gatherings of the encyclopedia set, but Rousseau's new moral seriousness turned him away from the insincerity, frivolity and atheistic tone of the conversation. He managed to provoke a quarrel which, although not so public as the Querelle des Bouffons, was much more wounding to all parties. Philosopher Diderot called Rousseau false, vain as Satan, ungrateful, cruel, hypocritical and wicked. He sucked ideas from me, used them himself and then affected to despise me. Abandoning the Encyclopedia coterie, Rousseau decided to write his own dictionary of music and refute the theories of his old bugbear Rameau once and for all. The 1760s saw the publication of another major philosophical work, The Social Contract. In contrast to what he saw as the secular materialism of writers like Diderot, Rousseau promulgated a fervent belief in the spirituality of man and the universe. The book alienated some powerful people, and then in his next one he made a humble Catholic cleric the mouthpiece for his new, unyielding views on religion. It's a devout work, but its very modern espousal of the idea that all religions are equal got him into a great deal of trouble. His books were banned and later burned. He was denounced by the Archbishop of Paris and friends turned away. Rousseau, as always, couldn't see what he'd done wrong, but he had to flee. Aristocratic friends helped him escape to Switzerland and then to England, where he stayed with friends of the Scottish philosopher David Hume. Rural Staffordshire only made him long for Paris. He didn't manage to learn any English, and his isolation led to a mental breakdown. Rousseau did have one English champion, though, Charles Burney, who admired his writing, perhaps feeling him to be a kindred spirit regarding the French. It must be confessed that his treatment of French music is very sarcastic, wrote Burney, not to say contemptuous. But the music, the national character, and exclusive admiration of their own music required strong language. It had been proved long since that they were not to be laughed out of their bad taste in any one of the fine arts. The national architecture, painting and sculpture were in general bad, and not what a traveller returning from Italy could bear to look at. Burney visited Rousseau and also made an English translation and adaptation of Le Devin. Burney's version, The Cunning Man, was premiered in London in 1762. And he wasn't the only musician to try this. In 1768, when he was only 12 years old, Mozart was supposedly commissioned by Viennese physician and magnetist Dr. Franz Mesmer to create an opera buffo. The result, Bastien und Bastienne, is a witty take on the pastoral genre epitomised by Rousseau's Le Devin du Village. Thank you. The overture to Mozart's youthful Bastien and Bastienne, played by La Cetra Baroque Orchestra Basel, directed by Andrea Marcon. Although officially barred from re-entering France before 1770, Rousseau returned 3 years earlier under a false name and married his housekeeper and long-standing mistress, the illiterate Thérèse, who shared his fondness for cooking. They were allowed to return to Paris in 1770 as long as he didn't attempt to publish anything. So once again, music came to the fore in his life. He wrote another opera, Pygmalion, and a set of four airs for clarinet duet, which are simple and charming. Here are the first two, an allegretto, and before that, Andante Grazioso. Of Rousseau's four airs for clarinet duet, played by Michel Portal and Paul Meyer. Despite the ban on publishing, Rousseau didn't stop writing, but when he began giving readings of his confessions, he was ordered to stop. The confessions weren't published until after his death. He had to support himself by returning to his old trade of music copying. His mental health was fragile, and he spent his last years in seclusion, apart from a satisfying encounter in 1774 with the composer Gluck, who admired Rousseau as a pioneer of the expressive natural style. In one of his last letters to Charles Burney, Rousseau sets down an appreciative analysis of Alceste, the first Italian version of which Gluck had submitted to him for suggestions. Deck Your Brows with Spring Flowers, a lyrical chorus from Gluck's opera Alceste, the chorus and orchestra of the Royal Opera House, Covent Garden, conducted by Charles Mackerras. In July 1778, while taking a morning walk, Rousseau collapsed and died at the age of 66. He's rightly remembered more for his philosophical and spiritual writings than for his musical output, but his dictionary of music is full of original good sense, and whether by accident or design, he proved himself to be an innovator in comic opera and the melodrama. At the very least, he enlivened the Parisian musical scene in the 1740s and 50s. I'm going to give the last word on Rousseau the musician to his admirer, Gluck. I am filled with admiration at the depth of his knowledge and the sureness of his taste. If he had applied himself to the exercise of the art he writes about, he might have achieved the marvellous results of which, according to antiquity, music is capable.
That was Catherine Bott reading Gluck. Today's Early Music Show was produced by Sam Phillips in Salford. And from tomorrow morning, a podcast version of that programme is available to download. All you have to do is go to the Radio 3 website and follow the links to the Early Music Show pages. And Jean-Jacques Rousseau is the subject of Night Waves this week. Philip Dodd will be exploring his influence and legacy. Night Waves every night, Monday to Thursday at 10 o'clock, with the Rousseau programme in the spotlight on Wednesday. Well, in just a moment, we have our Sunday concert. But first, here's a word from Alan Jones. The name completely went out of my head for a second. To look ahead to tonight's edition of The Choir.
Not in Our Time is a modern oratorio that wants to challenge the way you think and even the way we behave as a nation. This is music that's out to change the world, and it just might. It's already reached the top of the UK classical charts, is now taking America by storm too. Written for the 10th anniversary of the 9/11 attacks, Holy War is its subject, unpacked across 1,000 years of history through the words of popes and poets, presidents, and even Esquire magazine. Well, today on The Choir, I talk to the composer of Not In Our Time, Richard Blackford, about bringing a social conscience to bear in his art, and how he sees his oratorios fitting into a proud British tradition of politically engaged choral music. That's music and politics, powerful bedfellows, with me, Alla Jones, today. At 5 o'clock.
Alla Jones, how could I forget? The time now is 2 o'clock. You're listening to BBC Radio 3. It's time for our Sunday concert now, which was recorded recently in Austria. And I know who presented it too, Petrock Trelawney.
The BBC Philharmonic is on tour. Welcome to Austria, to the most western part of Austria, Bregenz. Its stunning arts complex is right on the edge of Lake Constance, or the Bodensee, a vast freshwater lake, the third largest in Europe. The city is famous for its spectacular open-air opera theatre that stretches out into the water. You may have seen its grand-scale productions of Aida and Tosca on television, the waters providing an impressive backdrop. Well, directly connected with the outdoor stage is the Festspielhaus, which is where we are, a venue for concerts and indoor opera. Today, welcoming the BBC Phil and its chief conductor, Juanjo Mena. He will conduct Mahler's Fifth Symphony. We're going to start with Shostakovich's First Cello Concerto. Now, we are pretty much at the meeting point of four nations here. We are in Austria. Tiny Liechtenstein is nearby. Germany also borders the lake, as does Switzerland. The Swiss frontier is just 10 miles away. And it's Switzerland that's the base for our soloist this evening, Sol Gabetta. Her picture on the posters around town for this concert. Well, Shostakovich's First Cello Concerto is just over half a century old. It was written in 1959 for Rostropovich. In four movements, it's an incredibly direct, intense concerto. The principal theme of the first movement returns to play a key role in the finale. Soviet commentators used to suggest that it represented the composer himself facing the conflicts and challenges of creative life in a dynamic society. The great Soviet conductor Kirill Kondrashin saw that struggle at play in the finale in particular, in which he argued, "We seem to hear the echo of accordions and the gay sounds of a folk festival. And yet here too we feel the pressure of antagonistic forces. The main theme of the coda," he argued, "seems to be born out of a struggle for its own existence." Well, Shostakovich included just one brass instrument in his orchestra, a single horn, which has an unusually prominent role, sometimes as friend and companion of the cello, sometimes as its antagonist. Yuri Tuchinsky, leader of the BBC Philharmonic taking his position on stage. This glorious concert hall, as I say, used as an opera theatre as well, but absolutely no compromise. The fly tower and the wings covered over to provide a magnificent acoustic for orchestral concerts. Here is Sol Gavetta with her chief conductor, Juanjo Mena, to join the BBC Philharmonic in this Bregenz performance of Shostakovich's first cello concerto.
Thank you.